would like to start this evening the first of our two sessions leading up to Purim. Purim, of course, is tonight, 2 weeks. In case you're wondering, there will be no shir in 2 weeks' time. In fact, if I will be capable of giving a shir at this point in 2 weeks' time, it can only mean that something will have gone terribly wrong. So we begin early. And as we normally prepare for Purim, we devote 1 week to Megillas Esther and 1 week to Inyanei Purim. And based on our schedule, we find ourselves this year looking at the ninth perek of Megillas Esther. If you have a Chumash Shemos, it's in the back of the Chumash. And the ninth perek, arguably one of the harder, if not the hardest, prokim to learn, because it's the longest perek, and there's a number of psukim that seem to be saying things that were said earlier on. I don't think we'll be able to do justice to the entire perek within an hour. Efes kotsehu nireh v'chulo lo nireh. But at the very least, to present some highlights and central themes within the perek. And so, perek tests, almost at the end. The Jewish people have already been given permission to defend themselves. The original Gezeira has been rescinded, overturned. And so the Pasuk reads, Uvishneimos HaChodesh, HuChodesh Adar. In fact, there has been a lapse of more or less 11 months from Perek Ches to Perek Ches. Most of the story of Purim, that those very intense days, happened on Pesach. The interceding of Esther and Mordechai, and very little happened in between. And then 11 months later, v'shneimos haChodesh uChodesh Adar v'shlosha asa yom bo, on the 13th of Adar, asher higiyat v'hamelech v'daso leheyosos, when the king's decree, finally the time had come for it to be done, fulfilled. Bayom asher sibru oyvei hayehudim lishlot bahem, the very day that the enemies of Bnei Yisrael, of the Yehudim, of the Jews, wanted to control them, v'nafochu, and as was with Purim, and this is where it is mentioned, everything was reversed, asher yishlatu hayehudim heima besonehem. They were the ones who were in control. We should note, it's very interesting, especially if we've heard these psukim often, that actually there's a shift in terminology within the pasuk. The pasuk tells us that this was the day asher sibru oyvei hayehudim, the enemies of the Yehudim, to control them, but then it was reversed, asher yishlatu hayehudim heima bisoneihem. It doesn't say asher yishlatu heima be'oivehem. In the beginning of the pasuk, we were talking about the enemies of the Jews. Towards the end of the pasuk, we're talking about the relationship with the sonim. What is the difference between oivehem and sonehem? That's an interesting question. And many mefarshim discuss this. The Vilna Gaon says the difference between them is that they are two types of negative relationships with, well, anyone, specifically here, the Jews. Oyev, as its name suggests, he is the enemy, and he is someone who is prepared to act on his enmity. A practicing opponent. A sone is more of an emotional condition, whereby this person has ill will, but he's not necessarily going to act on it. But he's quite happy to see others do the job for him. He has no positive feelings. But he, one could say, is a non-practicing enemy, is a sone. And that's also a form of aggression, certainly in creating a climate. Therefore, to describe the 13th of Adar, it was the day that the oyvei hayehudim sibru lishlot bahem. It was the day that the enemies of the Jews were hoping to control them, because they were looking forward to acting on their enmity. On that day, when matters were reversed, It was a complete reversal, whereby not only did the Jews have control over their oivim, but even the sonim. So it was absolutely from one extreme to the other. Interestingly, with this theme, if we take a look in Pasuk Vav, Pasuk Hey, Vayaku haYehudim bechol oyvehem, makas cherev vehereg vaavdon. So the Jews, they smote their oyvehem, their enemies, a very decimating and destructive victory. Vayasu besonehem kirtzonam. Once again, we see that duality whereby the confrontation with the oyvim was very much physical and mortal. Vayakub be'oivehem. When it comes to sonehem, it doesn't say that they killed the sonehem because the sonehem weren't going to kill them. The sonehem were just happy to sit back and watch. So vayasu b'sonehem kirtzonam means that they imposed on, says the Vilna Gaon, they imposed on this onim what they had wished. Namely, they had wished to see the enemies of Jews kill the Jews. They saw the Jews kill their enemies, and that is vayasu b'sonehem kirtzonam. So you have these two levels, really, of enmity towards the Yehudim. Oivim, befall, in actuality, and sonim, in terms of negative feeling, with the relevant psukim. Now, in Pasuk Beis, we find that the position of the Jews was decisive. That is to say, they were in an exceedingly secure position. Nikalu haYehudim be'orehem bechol medinos haMelech Achashverosh. So they gathered together in their cities lishloach yad b'mivakshei ra'osam, that they should impose harm on anyone who wished to do to them likewise. V'ish lo amad lifneihem, and no one stood before them. Ki nafal pachtam al kol ha'amim. The people were afraid of the Jews. There was a royal edict essentially supporting the Jews' right to lihinakem me'oivehem, and therefore that presented a certain level of fear on the nations around them. V'ish lo amad lifneihem, no one could stand before them. It's very interesting to compare Pasuk Beis with Pasuk Gimel, because Pasuk Gimel continues, v'chol sarei hamedinos v'chashtarpanim v'hapachos v'osei hamelacha asher lamelech menaseim es hayehudim. So we find that the sarei hamedinos, the officers, and all these are various terminologies of different levels of office, achashtarpanim v'hapachos, whatever they may mean, different types of officials, menaseim es hayehudim, they raised up the Jews, ki nafal pachad Mordechai Alehem. What we find is actually a double protection, in a sense, for the Jewish people, because there is a certain feeling that if we see the parallels between Pasuk Beis and Gimel, the Pasuk Beis discusses the feelings of the nations towards the Jews, and Pasuk Gimel discusses the feelings of the officials towards Mordechai. And what that means is, whereas Pasuk Beis tells us that it was known that the Jews were protected generally by this second decree from Achashverosh, and therefore, nafal pachdam al kol ha'amim, there was a natural sense of fear vis-a-vis the Jews for all nations. But actually, it went one step further than that, says the Malbim. Not only were the nations naturally, morale was low from their point of view, they were afraid, literally, to start with the Jews on this occasion. But moreover, there was active support for the Jews from Sarei Hamedinos. Menasim es hayehudim. They raised them up. That is to say that they gave them special status, protective status. Why? Why would they do that? Why would they go the extra mile? Says the Malbim, if it weren't for the fact that Mordechai was in the palace, which means that there was someone at the heart of the Malchus looking after Jewish interests, the Sarim would never have gone the extra mile. In other words, you have the natural lie of the land. People are afraid. Let them go to war. Whatever happens, happens. Why should we put ourselves out? but because they felt that their own position was somehow precarious, because if they were not seen actively to be looking out for Jewish interests on this occasion, which was really what the decree was about, so Mordechai has control over them. He's in the palace. And thus, you have a combination of Pachad HaYehudim over the Amim, which led to Ishlo Amad Lifnehem in Pasuk Beis, coupled with Pachad Mordechai on the Sarim, which led to Menasim Es HaYehudim. They not even made the Bnei Yisrael, gave them a certain degree of official protection. But there were conflicts, and there was a good deal of battle. And the Pasuk tells us that in Shushan, or Shushan Abir, Pasuk Vav, they killed 500 men, the 10 sons of Haman. And then in Pasuk Yud, Tzeres b'nei Haman, ben Hamadasa, Tzer ha-Yehudi, Haragu, Uvabiza, lo shalchu es yadam. They didn't touch the spoils. And that's actually something that will be said again in this parak. Uvabiza, lo shalchu es yadam. Whoever they killed, but they didn't touch the spoils. And the question is, why is that significant? And not only are we asking why is it significant, it's actually not what the edict was, that is to say, or at the very least, it was less than what the edict was. The second edict in Perek Ches says specifically, Leos Hasidim, Leom Azeh, Linakem Ovehem, Ushalolom Lavos. The spoils are there for the taking. And the Pasuk makes a point of saying, no, Uvabiza Lo Sholchu Es Yodom. Rashi comments on this twice. Firstly, in Perek Ches, where it says, Ushlalam lavos, in Perek Ches Pasuk Yud Aleph, says Rashi, Ushlalam lavos, Kasher nichtav barishonos. In other words, it was important that the second edict mirror and parallel as much as possible the first edict in order that it should be seen as its equal to undo it. And therefore, everything that was said in the first one, Shlalam lavos, was said for the benefit of Bnei Yisrael in the second one. But Rashi notes, of course, as we did, Vehem babiza lo shalchu es yadam. But they didn't touch the shalal. They were licensed to, they were allowed to by the king, they didn't touch it. Why? Sheheru lakol shelo nase l'shem mamon. They wanted to show that they were not doing this in order to get the money. Rather, they were simply looking out for themselves. They're looking to protect themselves. As long as they're able to do that, they're happy they don't need any of the spoils of war. And therefore, they eschewed that option of shlalam navos. Interestingly, Rashi comments again on this idea of uvabiza lo shalchu es yodam. And that is in our Pasuk Yud. And there Rashi says something slightly different. Shelo yitin hamelech ayin tzara bamamon. They did not wish to provoke any agitation with Achashverosh. In other words, they are very appreciative at this stage that Achashverosh is protecting them. Should he come to look at it as the Jewish people profiting from this, and they've actually ended up with money that maybe he would have liked, so maybe he will regret his decision or be less enthusiastic next time. And therefore, they don't wish to give Achashverosh any cause to regret having given them the opportunity to defend themselves. They don't touch the money. They don't need it. There is another approach entirely to this idea of Uvabiza lo shelchu es yodam. And that's to be found in the writings of Rabbeinu Bachi in his Perush at the end of Parshas Beshalach. And we preface, we're aware, certainly generally, that what's happening in Megillas Esther is a rehash and a re-experience of the conflict between the Jewish people and Amalek, certainly spearheaded by Haman Hagagi. But moreover, the Targum to Megillas Esther notes on all of the occasions that there are people being killed, and one can also intuit that they're probably the people that were most likely to wage war against the Jewish people, even though they've been told not to, And that's Amalek. That's how they're going to come out of the woodwork. Everybody else pretty much stayed at home. It's not in their interest anymore. Amalek have no interests sometimes other than waging war against the Jewish people, if the date was set, come what may. And therefore, most, if not all, of those who were killed were actually Amalekim, says the Targum. Rabbeinu Bachya says, and this is very interesting because it will bring us back, this is the laning for Purim morning, the actual war with Amalek. And the final word, the final pasuk of Parshas B'Shalach is, Bayomer, the famous pasuk, Ki Yod al Keska, a hand on the throne of God, which is a loshen of Shavua, Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek. It's a war for Hashem ba'Amalek, Midor Dor. Now, Rabbeinu Bachya says there's two ways to understand what the pasuk means when it says Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek. Does it mean Milchama l'Hashem means it's a war for Hashem to wage? As if to say, he will be the one who will wage the war, Milchama l'Hashem. It could be. However, says Rabbeinu Bachya, Al Derech HaPshat, Milchama l'Hashem means it's a war for Hashem. In other words, that the Jewish people need to wage this war. But it's a war for Hashem. Milchama l'Hashem. In other words, the reason why Amalek attacked the Jewish people is because they are God's people. And therefore, this is a war, to use the phrase advisedly, but we understand, it's a holy war. And this is a war representing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's interests. Because it's true, says Rabbeinu Bachya, so the war needs to be conducted just like everything that is L'Hashem needs to be conducted. Namely, L'Shem Shamayim. It has to be with no personal gain. Just like the Mishkan is Ve'osu Li Migdash, says Rashi, Li L'Shmi, Milchama L'Hashem means L'Shem Hashem. And therefore, although there may be trappings of wars in other situations that are entirely acceptable, says Rabbeinu Bachya, part of the modus operandi of Milchama L'Hashem ba'Amalek means there are no fringe benefits. There's no kickback in the form of shalal. And he moves us straight to Megillas Esther. That, says Rabbeinu Bachya, is why it says on a number of occasions, Uvabiza lo sholchu es yodom, because this was in the course of Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek, is l'Shem Shamayim. Now, Rabbeinu Bachya actually has opened up a very interesting question here. Even as we identify Haman as being descended from Amalek, and these other enemies of the Jewish people on this occasion descended from Amalek, but Rabbeinu Bachya has invoked the pasuk of Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek, it's the war with Amalek, with the various particulars that go with that. But that question actually is not so simple. It is possible that there need to be certain conditions prevalent in order to say it is the field for Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek. The Rambam seems to say that the war with Amalek is, in a sense, a progression of the mitzvah to appoint a king over Israel. That is to say, first, when Bnei Yisrael have a king, then we are in the zone of Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek. In a sense, that's a Gemara in Sanhedrin in the second Perek, Shalosh Mitzvos Nistavu Yisrael, when they came into Eretz Yisrael. The first is to appoint a king, and the second is then to destroy Amalek, which is very interesting. Because if that's true, then here we are in Megillas Esther, there is no king in Israel. It's possible that even if Amalekim were identified, and there was a war, but that was a war of self-defense, but it doesn't have the label and the designation of Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek. That mitzvah of Timcha Esecher Amalek, which applies when a king is there, if there's no king, so then it doesn't have that nature. Those Mefarshim would probably explain, like the first two Pirushim of Rashi, the reason why they didn't touch the Biza is because to show that they weren't in it for the money, or they didn't want to agitate Achashverosh, but not for Amalek-related reasons, just for political Achashverosh-related reasons. So that's an interesting question, because Rabbeinu Bachya, it seems very clear to him that in this conflict, we invoke everything that relates to the concept of Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek. And what's interesting is, there is grounds to suggest, for other reasons, that we were not invoking Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek with all that it entails. Because when the Pasuk says Timcha Asecha Amalek, so we need to be aware, we are aware in fact, if we've read Rashi, that there's another question. What does that entail? What is involved within Zecher Amalek? Does it refer to the people? Does it refer to anything else? Well, the Mechilta says, quoted by Rashi, Timcha Zecher Amalek means there should be no object remaining about which you could say that used to belong to Amalek. That is what Timcha Zecher Amalek means. Not everyone agrees. It is possible that Timcha Zecher Amalek refers to the race, to the people, but not necessarily to everything that they own. But Rashi famously says from the Mechilta that there can be nothing left, no object, and which you could say that used to belong to Amalek. If that's true, then we would have another question. Why did the Bnei Yisrael content themselves with not taking the shalal, taking the spoils? They should have destroyed it. If that property used to belong to Amalek, Timcha Zecher Amalek. Rabbeinu Bachya clearly understands that Timcha Zecher Amalek refers to the people. When it comes to the spoils, so there is just the rules of Milcham al Hashem. Don't take it, but you don't need to destroy it. But for those who say that when we do invoke Milcham al Hashem ba'Amalek, one needs to destroy everything, so the fact that they just held off from taking it but didn't destroy it is also evidence that we were not in the conditions of Milcham al Hashem ba'Amalek. What's interesting is, we speak about, did they take from Amalek? Did they didn't take from Amalek? They didn't destroy, but they didn't take. And each one will have their own way of explaining and understanding that. But one thing was taken from Amalek, and taken by at least a couple of Jews, Haman's house. Perek Ches, Achashverosh, right, took Beis Haman, and he gave it to Mordechai. Now that seems unusual according to any approach. Well, once again, if we say that we're not yet in Milcham al Hashem ba'Amalek, so then there's no concept of Timcha Zecher Amalek, but according to Rabbeinu Bachya, you can't take, but of course the answer would seem to be very simple. That was not something that was taken within the context of a war against Amalek. In fact, Haman was probably one of the only Amalekim who wasn't killed by Jews. He was killed by Achashverosh. And therefore the death of Haman did not come within the context of a conflict with the Jewish people. He actually engineered his own conflict with Achashverosh. Achashverosh killed him. And Achashverosh took his house. And then Achashverosh gave it to Mordechai. That's entirely acceptable. There's no limitations of Milcham al Hashem ba'Amalek under those circumstances. So these are very interesting discussions, as we see these words, Vabiza lo shalchu es yodam, they touch on this question a number of occasions throughout the parak. Now, as we know, all of this took place on the 13th of Adar. Achashverosh hears that on the 13th, 500 men were killed. Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayomar Melech Lester Amalka, B'shushan Abira Hagur HaYehudim Va'abei Chamesh Mirz Ish, Ve'esaseres B'nei Haman. So they killed 500, and the 10 sons of Haman, B'shar Medinus HaMelech Me'osu. One can only imagine what they did in the other provinces. And the Mefarshim explain, these are 500 people who in the very city of Achashverosh defied his edict. So one can only imagine, the further away you get, and the less sense there was of having to worry about Achashverosh, under his own nose, in his own backyard, so to speak, 500 men. Who can only imagine what happened with Shar Medinus HaMelech. Umashe Elaseich v'inasein lach, and he intuits that Esther will want something else. She didn't ask for anything. Achashverosh knows that she wants something else. What is it? Umabakashaseich od v'se'os. And indeed, Esther does want something else. Two things, in fact. Vatomer Esther, Imala Melech Tov, Yinanasin Gamachar, Layudim Asher Bashushan. Again, tomorrow, it seems, to finish it off. Lasoskadas Hayom, Vesaseris Bnei Haman Yislu Al Ha'etz. And to hang the 10 sons of Haman on the gallows. And it's a bit of a misunderstanding, perhaps, but it seems very clear from the Psukim that Haman's sons were not killed by hanging. Now, they were killed in the battle. They were. Esther is asking that the dead bodies of Haman's son should be hanged for all to see, as a deterrent, in order to further impose Achashverosh's protection of the Jewish people. So they were killed on that day. She asked that they be hanged. And she's asking for tomorrow, another day of what happened today. That's what it seems. But interestingly, it's possible that there's some slightly more that's going on here. For if we notice, Pasuk Vav, to move back, there was 500 people killed and the 10 sons of Haman. And then Esther asks, let the Jews in Shushan be able to do again tomorrow that which was done today. There is a shift in terminology, specifically in the way that she refers to Shushan, where the Pasuk refers to Shushan. In Pasuk Vav, when 500 men were killed, it is called Shushan Habira. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, when Esther asks for tomorrow, she asks for Ayudim Asher B'Shushan. So now let's ask the question. What's the difference between Shushan and Shushan Abira? Shushan was the Bira. So why is it sometimes called Shushan? Why sometimes Shushan Abira? Actually, there are many Mefarshim who understand that Shushan and Shushan Abira are not the same place. For Shushan Habira, which we say that the capital city, is more of a citadel city. That is to say, it is the royal city of Shushan within Greater Shushan. And that's where all of the royal officials live, and that's where all the work is done, and that's really the compound of the Malchus. Beyond that is Greater Shushan. Wherever you find the reference to Shushan Abira, it is that city within a city. And Shushan Stam is the broader city. And thus we find, for example, we've spoken about this at length, and in fact, Reuven Margolius in the Sefer Mikra Vamasora notes, having posited this from his own intuition, understanding of the Psukim, that when they excavated around about where they estimated the city of Shushan to be, they actually found the infrastructure of that type of citadel-type city within, which was confirmation of this idea that many Mefarshim had just from based on the Psukim. It was clear to them that this must be the case. We find, for example, and it changes everything, it adds a very new dimension. In the end of Perek Gimel, you have the two mentioned in the very same Pasuk as Haman's decree goes forth, Paschegan Akasadi Nasin Das Choleudim, Vadas Nitna Beshushan Habira, Vamelech Vaman Yoshvilish Dos, Vayir Shushan Navocha. So you have in the beginning a reference to Shushan Habira, Hadas Nitna Beshushan Habira, and in the end, Vayir Shushan Navocha. What does this mean? Says Rabbi Yosef Lekach, Rabbi Elezer Ashkenazi, the first of the Mefarshim to be discussing things in this way, that this is the point. Not everyone knew, as we know, what the to be ready for. The proclamation that went out beyond the walls of Shushan Abira was just to be ready. They didn't know about Lashmid, Larog, Labed, or anything like that. That's what made it much easier to rescind when the time came. Haman wanted to keep it all secret so the Jews wouldn't try and get out of it. Hadas nitna b'Shushan Abira. In Shushan Abira, the dust was known. Exactly what it was about. But the ir Shushan, navocha, they see people running in all different directions out of the Shushan Habira. No one knows what for. It's interesting, because we read it, v'ir Shushan navocha, in traditional, in the Eicha tune. But navocha literally means confused. Until word began to seep out as to what it was about. But initially, no one knew what all the commotion was about. In Shushan Abira, everyone knew. Beyond that, it was just confusion. By Shushan Navocha. And moreover, when Esther tells Mordechai that she's going to Achashverosh and Lech Konos as Kol Ayhudim Asher B'Shushan, because they are in Shushan Abira, because she's right next to the royal palace, she tells him to go and gather everyone in Shushan. And the final pasuk in Perek Dalet is Vayavor Mordechai. Mordechai, literally, Vayavor, passes over in order to spread the word. What does he pass over? Well, the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah, Arkas HaDemaya. He passes over a river. That's Arkas HaDemaya. says Reb Margolius, that's the moat between Shushan Abira and Shushan in order to get to the greater city. And therefore, with this in mind, and the Malbim also takes this understanding, so it's very interesting because we're used to the notion that Esther is asking what happened here today, let it happen tomorrow. But she's looking not only to repeat what happened today, but to expand what happened today. Because on the first day, 500 were killed in Shushan Abira. Esther is not asking for tomorrow also to be in Shushan Abira. Even in Shushan generally, she's looking to expand the operation in order to maximize, once again, the deterrent and the message that the Jews enjoy the king's protection and are entitled to defend themselves. So that's a very interesting insight that comes out from paying attention to the shift between Shushan Abira and Shushan. Now, in Pasuk Tet Zayin, we have a description of battle. Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayikalu, Ushar Yehudim Asher B'Medinos HaMelech, Nikalu Vamod Nafsham, V'Noach Mo'evihem, V'Rog B'Sonehem Chamisho V'Shivim Elef. So in other words, in the greater territories, there were actually 75,000 killed on the other side. Uvabizo Lo Sholchu Es Yodam. Now, the question is, in terms of Parshanut, what is happening in this Pasuk Tet Zayin, that hasn't been described already in Pasuk Beis? Because if we go back to Pasuk Beis, we find almost the same thing. Nikalu Hayudim Ba'areihem. Right? They got together in their cities. B'chol medinos ha-melech ha-chashverosh, l'shloach yad m'vakshei ra'asam, v'ish lo amad lefneihem, ki nafal pachtam al kol ha'amim. So that seems to more or less describe already the battle. It's been referenced in Pasuk Beis and once again in Pasuk Tet Zayin. What is the matter here with these two psukim? So the Malbim, once again, it begins with the Yosef Lekach, but the Malbim elucidates that actually Pasuk Tet Zayin is describing a different territory, a different area than Pasuk Beis. Of course, they're both outside of Shushan. But Pasuk Beis, when it says, Nikalu ha-Yehudim be'areihem, they all congregated inside their cities, that refers to the walled cities wherever they were. It's the walled cities, that was where things were most organized. That's where the king's law was most heeded. That's where there were officials. And therefore, the Jews inside the walled cities were relatively safe. And thus we find there's almost no resistance. No one could withstand them. It doesn't really sound like that many people started up with them. And there's no record of casualties. Especially in light of Pasuk Gimel, that they were protected by the officials. So they had a relatively mild time in the walled cities. Beyond the walled cities, the outlying provinces, where there was less organization and there was less officialdom, we find more lawlessness, and people were much more inclined to start up with the Jews. And that's Pasuk Tet Zayin. Ushar Yehudim Asher B'Medinos HaMelech. There is no Nikalu Be'orehem. You don't have those cities. They don't have the walls. They don't have the officials. It's just them. And the Pasuk doesn't say V'ish Lo Amad Bifnehem, because people, it was much easier to evade the arm of the law. And if people wanted to start up with the Jews, they could. And they did. And they lost. But that's where you had 75,000 killed in those areas. And this really is the beginning of the distinction between the walled cities and the unwalled cities. Pasuk Beis is the walled cities where they had their own Purim experience on the 13th. And Pasuk Tet Zayin is the unwalled cities. And what's interesting is we can see just in these terms, these two psukim describing two very different situations, the feeling of salvation was much more pronounced in the unwalled cities because they didn't have any sense of protection or any sense of organization. People started up with them and they defeated them. And thus we find an amazing thing. The very first mention of setting these days, or more correctly, the concept of Purim, of a Yom Tov, is in Pasuk Yotes. And it seems that it was spontaneous. It was a grassroots notion. Pasuk Yutet reads, Al-Kain, having described the various experiences of the Shara Yehudim and then the Jews in Shushan, Al-Kain Yehudim HaProzim HaYushvim Ba'ari HaProzos, therefore, Al-Kain means therefore, it is a direct consequence of what happened. After what happened to them, no one told them to make a Yom Tov, they made their own Yom Tov. Osim es Yomar Ba'asar L'chodesh Adar Simcho Mishtev Yom Tov Mishloach Monos Ishlari Ehu. Everybody felt that they should make it into a Yom Tov. Mordechai hadn't told them anything. But this was only in the process. The people in the walled cities were oblivious, more or less, to the danger. Not oblivious, but certainly they felt secure. And therefore they didn't really feel that they'd been saved. It all happened very naturally for them. So much so that Mordechai actually revolutionized things in the next pasuk, where he says, it said, the pasuk kaf, Vayichtov Mordechai. It is the first involvement of Mordechai in terms of instituting some form of day of commemorating this. Vayichtov Mordechai Sadvar Me'ele, Vayishlach Svarim El Kol HaYehudim, Asher Bechol Medinos HaMelech HaChashverosh, HaKrovim Barachokim. He's now sent out messages to everyone, wherever they are, near and far, lekayem aleim lios osim es yomar bas alachodesh adar ves yom chamisha asabo bechol shana vashana. In other words, what Mordechai did was he, on the one hand, ratified the move for a Yom Tov, which was on the part of the Prozim, but he then, his chiddush was, he also included the Mukafim, those that were in the walled cities. His message to them was, do not think that nothing happened to save you. If you knew what everybody else has been knowing around you in Shushan HaBira, a great deal had to happen in terms of the original edict of Haman, the way it was rescinded, etc. and so forth. You've also been the recipients and the beneficiaries of great kindness from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If there's a day to commemorate, if there's commemorating to be done and celebrating to be done, it's for everyone, not just the Prozim. The Prozim knew it. And now the Mukafim also need to know it. But they need to be told by Mordechai. They didn't sense it themselves. What's very interesting to note is that as Purim spreads, it also goes down slightly. And by that we mean, if we take a look very closely at Pasuk Yudtes, which, as we have mentioned through the Malbim, this was the Yom Tov that the Prozim themselves accepted upon themselves. Al-Kain Yehudim HaProzim HaYoshvim Ba'ari HaProzos Osim Es Yom HaBarasa L'Chodesh Adar Simcha U'Mishte V'Yom Tov U'Mishloach Manos Ishlari Ehu. There are four things mentioned. Simcha and Mishte are watchwords for Purim. Yom Tov, this is the first and last time Purim will be referred to as a Yom Tov. And the reason why, and it seems that Yom Tov means real Yom Tov. That is to say, like what we call Yom Tov, with no malacha, etc. And interesting, just there's no mention of Matanis Levyonim. Only Mishloach Manos. Because you can't give, you can't touch money on Yom Tov. It really sounds like it was a Yom Tov. So whatever, they could do on Yom Tov. Now, was that acceptable? Of course. As individuals or even as communities, they can accept upon themselves a day of Yom Tov. Things change when Mordechai is the force behind it. And the reason why is because he represents the Sanhedrin. He's the head of the Sanhedrin. And therefore, if Mordechai mandates something, it will have the form of a takana. And the head of the Sanhedrin, representing the Sanhedrin, has limitations. Because the Torah says, Lo sosifu al hadavar, that is an injunction to the Sanhedrin not to add anything which is another equivalent or an additional mitzvah to the Tariq mitzvahs with the same force. The Rabbanon added many mitzvahs to Rabbanon, but they were always very careful to mark them off from mitzvahs to Araisa. They have many very different halachas. And therefore, people can accept the Yom Tov on themselves. If Mordechai now comes in and he is making a takana for the entire Jewish people, so it spreads to everyone, but once it has the form of a takana, it cannot be a Yom Tov. And thus we find in Pasuk Kaf Beis, the shape of Purim, the way Mordechai mandates it is, Kayamim asher nachu behem hayehudim me'oyveihem, v'chodesh shenapach lehem miyogun l'simcha me'evo l'yomtov, la'asos osam yimei mishte v'simcha, mishloach manus ish re'eu matonus le'evyonim. There's no yomtov anymore, and now there's matonus le'evyonim. Once it's the takon of the Sanhedrin, it's got to be very different than the yomtov of the Torah. And at this point, the Megillah actually discusses the name of the day. In Pasuk Kaf Vav, Al Kain, Karu LaYamim HaEle Purim Al Shem HaPur. Purim Al Shem HaPur. And this is very interesting, because the Pasuk goes out of its way to tell us why it's called Purim, because of the poor. And for us, one could say the poor, that the lots that Haman drew, are arguably the least significant of that which happens in the story of Purim. They're part of the story, but they don't seem to be a key factor. When we would describe it in our terms, we would talk about Haman's schemes, and it's true, he went home, he cast lots, and that's just in terms of timing. But forces for and against, the poor doesn't seem to be a significant entity for us. But the Megillah is telling us that it is the center of everything. It is the name of the day. And if it's the name of the day, that means that it encapsulates everything. But how can this be so? Why is it so? So, of course, we're on slightly unfamiliar territory talking about lots and et cetera and so forth. We're out of touch with the way these things were and should be understood. But the Vilna Gaon explains, at least to discuss it in a general sense, that the concept of Hipil Pur is not a random act. It would have been very frustrating if that was the case for Haman. He's burning with anger to kill the Jewish people, and then the Pur gave him 11th month wait. He should have demanded a recall. So the concept of the Pur, however it was done, whatever the way in which it was done, it was in order to ascertain and to fathom the time of the year that was the worst for the Jewish people in terms of the mazolos, in terms of forces of nature at their highest level, when the Jewish people were at their lowest ebb. Mazolos generally are not kind to the Jewish people. The Jewish people don't exist, strictly speaking, based on mazolos. The Avram Avinu, when he was told that he was going to have a child, and naturally speaking, he can't have a child, the Pasuk says, Vayotzeyo Sevachutza, Kodesh Baruch Hu took him out. And Rashi says he took him out. He said, leave your astrology. Avram Avinu understood Mazolus representing the divine flow from on high, the natural way that the world works. Mazal from the word nozel, to flow. And in a sense, the Jewish people do not begin in pure terms based on Mazalas. Avram shouldn't be able to have any children. And therefore, a system whereby which doesn't recognize that you exist is hardly likely to be kind to you, even at the best of times. And certainly, the 13th of Adar, that was a low point for the Jewish people, a high point for Amalek, and the two define each other, that seesaw arrangement. And therefore, the more we appreciate this, the more we'll understand that ultimately the salvation of the Jewish people frustrated and overturned essentially the forces of nature, which allowed then, of course, everything else to proceed smoothly, and the Jewish people were victorious. And what we would call the good fortune of the Jewish people was essentially engineered by overturning and frustrating the what should have been in terms of the mazolos. So much so, and the more we would know about that, the more we'd appreciate that the word Purim says everything. Hipil Pur and Pur Haman Nepach L'Purenu says everything, because it vouchsafes the Jewish people ultimately against any force in nature that's looking to annihilate them. And that's why we say, Tshuvasam Ha'Yisrael Netzach V'Tikvasam B'chol Dor V'Dor. It was an eternal salvation, because things will never naturally look darker for the Jewish people than they did then. But when it was the survival of the Jewish people at stake, HaKadosh Baruch Hu stepped in, so to speak, and overturned everything. Tikvasim b'chol dor v'dor. There's no generation that should be without hope as a result of that. And that's the name of Purim. The Jewish people, of course, enthusiastically accept all of this. They accept this new day, these new mitzvahs. Pasuk Kaf Zayin tells us,
Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim aleihem va'azaram va'kol hanilvim aleihem.
Even those that become attached to the Jewish people, converts and the like, who they themselves were not in danger, but they're attaching themselves to the Jewish people.
V'lo yavor, and will never be rescinded. Li'os osim eshnei hayomim me'ele kichsavim v'chizmanam b'chol shana v'shana.
And interestingly, because the from a halachic point of view, and the Gemara does talk about it, the Yerushalmi certainly, to institute a new Yom Tov, I mean, this was the first, and from a point of view of Tanakh, the only special day that was part, now becomes part of the Jewish calendar. And there were issues of Bal Tosif, can it be done, another special day, you already have the Sholosh Regalim and the Yom Neroim, and here comes Purim, is it accepted? Is it acceptable? And is it accepted? And that is why Shmuel tells us in Maseches Megillah, Daf Zayin, Omed Aleph, that the answer is yes, and the reference to that is in Pasuk Kaf Zayin, where it says, Kimu v'kiblu. Now, Kimu v'kiblu, says Shmuel, means, darshans, Kimu lemala, mashekiblu lemata. It was upheld on high, it was ratified on high in Shamayim, that which they accepted upon themselves down here. Now, that's quite a thing to say. The Pasuk seems to be more or less straightforward, Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim. Except the point is, the drash always comes in when the pshat leaves something open. As much as we say these words often, Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim, there's a pshat problem. Because it's reversed. You can't uphold something until you've received it. First you mekabel, and then you mekayim. That way you mekabel. You can't be mekayim before you've received. The Pasuk thus should have said, Kiblu v'kimu. And because it says Kimu v'kiblu, says Shmuel, there is something else going on here. Namely, as he says, Kimu lamala mashekiblu lamata. And thus, Purim is secured for what it is, the way Mordechai set it, that was accepted lamala. Now, Tosfos raises an interesting question on Shmuel's drasha on the words Kimu v'kiblu. Again, Shmuel said Kimu v'kiblu means Kimu lamala mashekiblu lamata. Says the Tosfos, I have a question. Because these words are actually darshaned, these very same words are darshaned elsewhere in the Talmud in a very different way. And as we know, as a rule, you can't darshan indefinitely, generally speaking, each word comes to tell you one thing. What drasha is Tosfos referring to? To the famous statement in Maseches Shabbos on Daf Peches, Amud Aleph, which addresses the fact that originally when we received the Torah, as the Pasuk states, we read it a couple of weeks ago, by Yisyatzvu betachtis Sahar, we stood, it seems, at the bottom of the mountain, says the Gemara underneath the mountain. Melamed shakof aleim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Sahar ki gigas HaKadosh Baruch Hu suspended the mountain and said, decide, if you receive the Torah, good. If not, not good. Shom teik v'raska. And the Gemara says, well, doesn't this seem to empty out the Kabbalah of its meaning, certainly of its sincerity? It doesn't really sound like they had much of a choice. Modo'ah, it seems to be a disclaimer. Modo'ah rabba, l'oraisa. And Rava commented and said, it's okay. Hadar kiblua bimei Achashverosh. Subsequently, it was received in the days of Achashverosh. The days of Purim. Purim is a time of Kabbalah HaTorah. How do we see this? As it says, Kimu v'kiblu. Kimu, they upheld, mashekiblu kvar. In other words, at that point it's cemented through events of Megillas Esther. Anything that was missing or perceived to be missing at the time of Kabbalah HaTorah was very much present at the time of Esther, and Kabbalah HaTorah was set. What are the implications for the 1,000 intervening years? That's a question for that sugya. But at the very least, we do see that the Gemara has darshan Kimu v'kiblu for the very same reason that it should have been Kiblu v'kimu, but Kimu v'kiblu is a very different way. It actually means they were mekayim what they had already been mekabel at Har Sinai. But that's at odds with what Shmuel seems to be saying, that Kimu v'kiblu doesn't work chronologically, but works celestially. It's not about being mekayim what they had been mekabel, it's about in Shamayim being mekayim what, at that time, Bnei Yisrael, the Jewish people, had been mekabel. How can there be room for these two drushers? They seem to too much traffic for these words Kima v'Kibla? That's Tosus's question. Says the Vilna Gaon, and this is quoted by the Hagos Cheshek Shlomo in Maseches Megillah, Taf Zion there. Says the Gaon, the way that there's room for two drushes here is because if you look at the words in Pasuk Kaf Zayin, Kimu V'Kivlu, you will see that there is a Kriuksiv. Kimlu is written as we would expect, Kuf Yud Mem Vav. V'Kivlu is not written as we would expect, Vav Kuf Beis Lamed, and no Vav. It is written as if it is in the singular V'Kibel. It is read in the plural V'Kiblu. Says the Vilna Gaon, now we know how there is a possibility to darshan two separate things. Because there is the drosha lefi the kri and the drosha lefi the ksiv. One darshans it as if it's kimu v'kiblu and one darshans it as kimu v'kibel. How so? Shmuel's drosha, says the Gaon, when kibu lemala, mashe kiblu lemata, that's kimu v'kiblu, lemala and lemata. And that's according to the Kri, the way that it's read. Rava's drosha in the Gemara in Shabbos is according to the Ksiv, Kimu v'Kibel. They were Mekayim. Kibel is in the singular, either referring to Moshe, the individual who was Mekabel the Torah for us, or a reference to the Jewish people who, as we know, were Ki'ish Echad Belev Echad at the time of Matan Torah, and therefore Kimu v'Kibel lefi the Ksiv is Rava's drosha. And thus, there are two streams within these words which allow for both drushes. And the Gaon hasn't finished. Because, says the Gaon, if you look in the two Gemaras, you will see. In the Gemara in Megillah, on Daf Zayin, which talks about Lamala and Lamata, it says, Kimu Lamala, Mashe Kiblu Lamata, Shene Emar, Kimu V'Kiblu. Okay. If you look in the Gemara in Shabbos, there it says, Kimu, Mashekiblu Kvar, they upheld what they'd already, Dichtiv, Kimu, Vikiblu. Says the Gaon. The very same pasuk is referred to in both Gemaras, but it is introduced in two different ways. In the Gemara in Megillah, it is introduced with the word Shene'emar. And in the Gemara in Shabbos, it's introduced with the word Dichsiv. What is the difference between Shene'emar and Dichsiv? Says the Gaon, it's what it sounds like. Shene'emar is what was said, and Dichsiv is what is written. Because that's the difference between the two drushes. In Maseches Megillah, Kimu v'Kiblu, that's decree. That's how it's read. That's not how it's written, and therefore it's introduced with the word Shene'emar. That's what it says. But in Maseches Shabbos, it's specifically the way that it's written, V'Kibel, and thus is the Pasuk introduced with the word Dichsiv. That's out of this world. Most of us will probably spend much of the time in the Ad Lo Yoda Ben Shene'emar and Dichsiv until the Vilna Gaon says they're two separate things entirely. Classic Vilna Gaon. Final comments, which relate to, in a sense, the final psukim. Because in Pasuk Kaftes, we have, everything's happened really already. The Megillah could have ended in Pasuk Kafches. Purim is set, it's been promulgated, it's been received, accepted, established, and that's it. And then Pasuk Kaftes happens. V'tichtov Ester HaMalka bas Avichayel u'Mordechai HaYehudi es kol tokef. They write kol tokef, all strength. Very elusive phrase. Lekayem es Igeres HaPurim azos HaShenis, to establish the second Igeres HaPurim. What is the second Igeres HaPurim? It sounds a lot like the first Igeres HaPurim. What upholding needs to be done? And the very same question, that is to say, Igeres HaPurim has already been written in Pasuk Kaf, Vayichtov Moshe, Mordechai Sadvarim Ha'ele, Vayishlach Svarim HaKol HaYehudim. Hadvarim Ha'ele, says Rashi, is the text of the Megillah. It's been written in Pasuk Kaf. And now in Pasuk Kafes, they're writing it again. Lekayim. What does that mean? The very same question seems to apply to Pasuk Lamed Aleph,
which says lekayem es yemei Purim eile bizmanehem, to uphold the days of Purim, but the days of Purim have already been upheld. Did we not say kima v'kiblo aleihem va'azaram? There doesn't seem to be any more upholding that can happen. So what is the significance of these final psukim? Says Rav Soloveitchik, in an excerpt from the Yortzeit Rosh's Shiurim, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Megillah there in Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, Shalcha Esther lachachamim. Esther sent a message to the chachamim. Kisvuni l'doros, literally write me for all generations. What does she mean? What she is asking is for Megillas Esther to be incorporated into Kisvei HaKodesh, into the Tanakh, which ultimately it was. That was the petition of Esther. Kisvuni l'doros. That it should have the status, the ma'amad of Kisvei HaKodesh. Once it does, the Sefer of Tanakh is a different level altogether. Says Rav Soloveitchik, that is the difference between the writing initially in Pasuk Kaf and the second writing in Pasuk Kaf Tes. In Pasuk Kaf, at the time that it happened, Bayichtov Mordechai Sedvar Meil, he wrote it. And maybe he even wrote the same words or the same substance or Bayishlach Sfarim HaKol HaYehudim. Everybody heard the story. But at the time, that's what it was. A story. An amazing story. They just experienced it. Should be preserved for all posterity. Etc. and so forth. But that's what it is. Pasuk Kaftes, as the Pasuk introduces, Vatichtov Esther Amalka Bas Avichal Mordechai Yehudi, Es Kol Tokef. Kol Tokef means maximum strength. What is the greatest Tokef at that time that anything written could attain? Entry into Kisvei HaKodesh. Kol Tokef. That is its greatest Takifut. Kisvuni Ladoros. And that is why the Pasuk says, L'kayem es Igeres Hazeh, to uphold. For there is no greater upholding of the Igeres of Purim than incorporating it into the Kisvei HaKodesh. It was, in our terminology, upgraded from the works of Mordechai to Kisvei HaKodesh. And then, says Rav Soloveitchik, just one final step. As we know, the mitzvahs of the Megillah, they're not the Oraisa, of course, this is after Tirag Mitzvahs, but they're, according to many, they have a higher status than Mitzvahs Derabbanon pure. And the reason is because they're written in the Tanakh. They are what's known as Divrei Kabbalah. The Gemara discusses Mitzvahs that are to be found in the Nevi'im and Ksufim as Divrei Kabbalah. And what that means is it bestows upon them a higher status than Derabbanon only, even if it's not yet full de Oraisa. We will treat them more stringently if they're to be found in Kisvei HaKodesh. And for example, as we know, there's many cities that are not sure where they ruled from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun, yes and no, Yafo, and etc. and so forth. What do they do? Well, as we know, the halacha is they read both days. Now, some would argue that if you're not sure, and if reading Megillah is Derabbanan, then perhaps we're not saying don't read any day, but read one day and take a pick. And they read both days, and it seems from the Rambam that they have to read both days. Why is this so? Says the Turi Evan, because reading the Megillah is Divrei Kabbalah. It is more stringent than we don't say Safek Derabbanan and Lekula. If you're not sure, out of doubt, read both days, night and day. And there are other examples of the extra strength of the mitzvahs of Megillah because they're in Kisvei HaKodesh. Says Rav Soloveitchik, of course we understand these mitzvahs would never attain that status had the Igeres of Purim not attained the status of Kisvei HaKodesh. Divrei Kabbalah are mitzvahs that are to be found in the Tanakh. These mitzvahs won't be found in the Tanakh until Megillas Esther is to be found in the Tanakh. And therefore, when Esther petitions Kisvuni Ladoros, she's actually asking for two things. Number one, the upgrading of the Sfarim of Mordechai to be one of the Sfarim of Kisvei HaKodesh, Lekayim Esigeres HaPurim HaZos. And in so doing, she is also asking for the upgrading of the mitzvahs of Purim, which everyone had already received from Mordechai. But they're receiving it from Mordechai. Mordechai is the head of the Sanhedrin that makes the mitzvahs Derabbanan. But once the Igeres HaPurim has received Kol Tokef, the mitzvahs of Purim also receive Kol Tokef. And they now become mitzvahs, I say, midivrei Kabbalah, and that is Lekayim es Yemei HaPurim HaEle, full tokef. These are the words of Rav Soloveitchik. Of course, in his way, it's halachic way, but these are the halach. This is the halachic section of the Megillah. This is where the mitzvahs are, and that is a way to understand what is happening within the course of these final psukim. We'll leave it over there for this evening.